today I have the pleasure of talking with Dave F. Rose. He is considered the number one angel investor in New York City. Dave, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Maybe could you just tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Sure. I regard myself primarily as an entrepreneur and secondarily as an angel investor. And my background is what you would expect for an entrepreneur. That is, has nothing whatsoever to do with anything I'm doing. I am...
What, like a history or something?
Actually, I'm trained as an urban planner. I have a degree in urban planning from Yale, and then went to politics. I spent a number of years working for Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was at that point New York senior senator, as his urban affairs expert, and ended up running his regional office in New York, where my
so
boss
was... about Robert Moses, then?
Oh, absolutely.
I'm reading the book, The Power Broker, right now.
That's a great book. I know Bob Caro, and my father actually knew Moses, and the kids have studied Moses. So, you know, in our house, Moses is a well-known figure.
I'm really curious. Is it positive or negative overall on that?
Well, it's a really tough question. He was a very complex character. He did some extraordinary things, and he had effects that were very far-reaching. They weren't always to the good, but in general, I think history looking back would say this man was a positive influence on the city. He was an important influence, and ultimately a positive one, although things happened along the way that were, you know, if you had to do it over again, you wouldn't necessarily do.
Just for those listening, Robert Moses is the guy that basically built Manhattan during the about 40s through to the 60s or 70s, and he was unelected and basically came from nowhere and became pretty much the most powerful guy in New York City and potentially in the entire state. And he just did it all from behind the scenes. It's a fascinating story. I'm sorry to change the subject. Please keep going on.
The problem. So my background is in planning. I then went into politics, working for Senator Moynihan, ended up running his regional office in New York. And then after a couple of years, I was having so much fun in politics. I was conducting congressional investigations, and I was sitting on boards representing the senator with the mayor of the city. And here I was, a 21 or 22 year old kid. And I figured I'd be stuck there for life if I didn't get out. And also, I realized that at heart I was an entrepreneur. I wanted to be involved in the private sector. So I regretfully left Moynihan and went back to business school and got an MBA in finance and joined my family's business, which was real estate development. My father's an entrepreneur, and my family goes back a number of generations in real estate. And so I spent the next 10 years working in real estate development on the East Coast of the U.S., New York City, Boston, Washington. Along the way, as a hobby, started playing around with computers. I'd actually started playing with computers in 1979, and so I brought that into my work. I created the world's first computerized real estate sales office in 1982, thereabouts.
They ran on punk cards or something back then, wasn't it?
No, it was actually Apple II, believe it or not. And it got a full page rep in the world. It was using state-of-the-art network hard drives and all kinds of cool stuff. Then later on, we were the first company to provide computers and networks with every apartment that we sold in condominiums. We actually had a building account on the source, and every apartment came with an Apple II computer or terminal and an account on the source. We had building land effectively. We did all kinds of really cool early stage stuff. And then on the side, I started a company with one of my business school professors. It was called the Computer Classroom. It was one of the very first computer training companies. We did corporate training in this brand new world of spreadsheets and word processors and so on and so forth. And I kept going. I was very active online, so I was one of the early sysops of the system operators of the online forums on CompuServe. By the 1984 came around, Apple introduced the Macintosh. I was the original disk librarian, as we called them then, of the New York Magazine.
Was there an Amiga or a Commodore 64?
No, I was an Apple guy from early on. I had an Apple II in 1979, and then moved from to an Apple III, which was pretty cool. Moved to a Lisa. I was head up one of the very first Lisas, one of the very first Mac. I was actually one of Microsoft's biggest sites for just Excel before it was released. Later in my career, I switched to the PC world for a while, and then ultimately switched back, so I'm primarily a Mac guy.
I started in 1985, or 90, I think 85 or 86, so yeah, you're right. You're a dinosaur.
Well, you know, what happened was, sure, I wasn't real estate, did demo on computers as a hobby, and then after the Mac came around, I went to the first Mac World Trade Show, and all these people that I had known in the online world through CompuServe and the source and other kinds of places, and were doing all these little startup companies with these exciting little 10-foot booths. Back then, the early trade shows, you could fit the whole trade show into a teacup. And so I thought this was really cool. So I wanted to get involved, and I went back the next year, and it was interesting. I realized that all the exhibitors were getting invited to the really cool parties for only exhibitors, and that the poor attendees like me didn't to go to the parties. So I want to go to the parties, so I need to be an exhibitor. So next year, I got a booth at the Macworld Trade Show, and so I can be an exhibitor. But then, of course, having a booth, I had to have something to put in the booth. So that's how I started my next company. I had to create a company to backfill to put into the booth. And I saw in a catalog, one of the major catalogs, a digital watch that Seiko had put out, which had 2K of RAM and a little serial port, so that you could download information from your computer to your watch. It had been a total disaster for Seiko with that one. But I figured, this whole world of Macs, maybe we can do software to tie it to your Mac. So we got the last 10 units that they had in the catalog and got some people together virtually, and we created a product called RiskMech. and took to the show, and it was a bit of a hit. Somebody in the press room was overheard saying, you know, best thing here at that show is that watch, but what a cheesy salesman. Because I was doing this place as my sort of Von Popiel sales act. And that was a lot of fun. I did that as a hobby. And then the next thing I know, over a number of years, we went from the wristmat, which eventually ended up flying on a space shuttle and became the space shuttle watch, to looking for a wireless version of that. But then realized that the wireless wristwatch pager stuff wasn't very effective. So we ended up moving into paging software. We became the largest developer of wireless messaging software for all the major paging companies. And then the next thing you know, the whole spectrum auctions in the U.S. came around with the PCS networks like Nextel and Sprint and so on. And we ended up doing all the software for them. By this point, I had moved on from real estate into the tech stuff full-time. So we were a large developer of wireless messaging software. Then we began to do back-end services. We did the back-end web service for Sprint PCS that connected their phones to the web, and the messaging software for Nextel and a lot of other players. We were then brought on to the wireless press system for the Olympics in Atlanta, finished the entire system, and they decided that they should sponsor, so they decided not to ship it, but we got to keep that. We went into online information services, and as the world's moving very rapidly, that pointed us in the direction of doing something with the Internet, because the Internet clearly was going to take over the world from dial-up software. And so we said, what happens if you can run wireless with wireless messaging we're doing with the Internet? And we created one of the first wireless data networks for the Internet called AirMedia Live Information Network. And so we had a hardware device that we invented that plugged into your serial port. We did deals with a wide range of sources for content, from CompuServe and AOL to PC Quote and CBS Sportsline and so on, and send out information on a push basis that would come into your computer even though you weren't online. You'd come in wirelessly. It would fly across your screen. And that got to be a pretty big thing. That actually got a full column by Walt Musburger in the Wall Street Journal when it launched. Venture capital began to flow into us. We raised quite a bit in VC. And by the time mid-90s came around, the company had about 120 people based both on the West Coast and East Coast. We were doing versions of this for companies like Compaq and Global Village and NEC and Hewlett Packard the like. We were the wireless push technology leaders. I don't know if you remember way back in that time when you had Pointcast was the push technology on the wireline. We were, AirMedia was the wireless stuff. And then the product shipped, and with a lot of fanfare, and nobody bought it, which was very depressing. So that was the end of phase one. We basically crashed and burned with a spectacular product that everybody loved, but nobody bought. And the question is what to do next. So at that point, we had this extraordinary back-end infrastructure, and we went to our investors and said, hey, we have another idea to leverage our infrastructure with this whole Internet thing that's happening, and let's be a back-end for the wireless Internet, whether you're using SMS or text or XML or voice, whatever it is, we'll be the back-end for the wireless Internet. And so we restarted the company and hit the boom at the right time, and the next thing you know, we had more venture capital, and we were expanding to Europe. We acquired a company in the U.K. By this point, we had investors including Richard Branson's folks and Symantec and all kinds of other players. We had offices in London, in Paris, in Germany, things were going really interestingly. And the only thing that could possibly have hurt us was if everything simultaneously crashed and burned, you know, the Internet and wireless and everything else. Unfortunately, that's exactly what happened. So we had this some great technology, great system. The dot-com crash came along, and the next thing we know, I'm back on the street again. At which point, my long-suffering spouse said, enough is enough, no more of this entrepreneurial stuff. So I said, okay, went back, got my help in my kids at high school, into college, rather, went back to one of my avocations, my hobbies of letterpress printing, wrote a book on letterpress printing, stayed out of the tech world for, 6 months or so. When along came somebody I had known from the glory days, the guy who actually had invented social networking, an entrepreneur named Andrew Weinrich, who created the website Six Degrees, which was the first social networking site. He had sold that for over $100 million in stock. Along came crash, he would die out of the street. So he had an idea for a new company to do a distributed Wi-Fi hotspot network. He showed me the idea. I liked it. I asked if I could advise him, which I did. And so I invested a few dollars into helping get that started. And the next thing you know, we're off the races again with Voltage. This is Andrew's company, where I was on the board and an investor. I was joined in that by Nicholas Negroponte and some other really interesting early-stage investors. That was the middle of the nuclear winter, as we called it, in the angel world. And so we could not get any VCs to finance anything, though we had strategic investors who were willing to invest along with VCs. So at that point, that company was called Jiltage. Eventually, quietly closed down. But now now I knew that I'd lose money both as an entrepreneur and as an investor. So I said, okay, well, what do I join? And I joined a local, I realized it was an angel group because I realized I was an angel investor. And that was a group of investors who had been pulled together by the New York New Media Association, which I had helped found way back in the early mid-90s. And so there I found other of these people called angels who would invest in early-stage startups, and I did some investments, some small investments through that group. And then it turned out that the Trade Association itself closed down because they had, in the middle of this nuclear winter, 8,000 unemployed dot-com types, all looking to get jobs from the other 8,000, so that didn't quite work. But we then took the angel group, since I wasn't allowed to start a company, according to my spouse, and we had the business plan for the angel group as a not-for-profit, and we started New York Angels, which this is now 7 or 8 years ago, has become the most active serious angel group in the New York area, and started doing investing on a more or less full-time basis. And so having then over the years invested in over 75 companies or so, about 5 years ago, I was looking around at the whole angel world and realizing how difficult it was to administer a group of 75 type A personalities as who were these angel investors and reviewing hundreds and hundreds of funding applications each year, and there are no tools. I searched the whole world, and there were no tools at all. And decided ultimately that there was a market hole here, and if one could provide a tool set to help bring angel investors and early stage entrepreneurs together, there was in this age of exponential technological growth a lot of good stuff that came out of that. And so I created, finally got permission from my spouse to start another company, and I started a company called Angelsoft. And so today, here I am with a company called Angelsoft, which provides the back end infrastructure for virtually every angel investment group in the world, over 500 of them, 45 countries. There are over 20,000 accredited investors who use a platform to process over 3,000 business plans each month. I'm myself actively investing in a dozen more companies every year. And then physically here in New York, I set up an incubator and a co-working space. And so as a essentially a crazy entrepreneur, I end up these days working 16, 17-hour days, 7 days a week, and having the time of my life. So in a nutshell, that's the story.
Interesting. Well, I have a key question, I think, that maybe ties all of this together, if I may.
Sure.
How was the party?
The party turned out to be pretty interesting, although it was a lot of geeks running around, and there were a few early-stage techie types who, artistic types, who were involved in tech. Surprising ones. For example, do you know that the Judy Collins, the folk singer, was an Apple fanatic from early on, and she would take apart her Apple II and, stick in cards and work on the OS stuff, and Todd Rundgren was a programmer, so there were some folks in that area who got involved. But for the most part, you had a lot of geeks, but that was my crowd. The online forums on CompuServe, in the Macintosh forums that I was a system moderator for, get together at these events once a year, and I became sort of, we called it the sushi op, because we had the sushi banquets, and I was like the social butterfly.
Yeah, you can be all this elaborate stuff, and the Indians went to the booth bag. Come on, let's
get absolutely.
Really
so, well, we would have these banquets, these sushi banquets at each age trade show, and there was an enormous amount of fun. I at one point way back in the dark ages, when there was a party, an after party at one of these events, and my hotel room was crowded with all kinds of interesting people. Next thing I know, there's this crazy bearded guy who was working on my phone, on my hotel room phone, taking it apart and wiring stuff up, and I looked, and it turned out to be a guy named John Vapor, better known as Captain Crunch. Who was the first?
Oh, really? You met John Draper?
Yes.
Would you have taken you by the time you met him? Or no?
He was a very interesting character. Been saying, there's hotel security in my room, and it was a very interesting time, to put it that way.
Yeah. John Draper was Captain Crunch. He was one of the good guys that basically invented blue boxing,
yep.
Using a system for free time goals. Let's not go down that, because we do need to talk about business here. Now, I'm interested to know, the stories you told, I'm actually surprised, because you're a sharp New York guy, you're aggressive, you're direct. The sort of stories I usually hear from guys like you is, I kicked ass in this and I did great in that and, then we did this really well. But, most of the stories you told through the beginning of this call were pretty horrendous. You've gone up, over and over. They're not good, right? It sounds your wife said you couldn't go and start a business, but that sounds like this stuff really affected your marriage. It sounds like a lot of stuff went really wrong, and now you've managed to put it together. Maybe can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The answer is I now do a lot of talking and teaching about entrepreneurship. I was a mentor of the year last year at New York NYU Stern Business School. I'm on the Entrepreneurship Advisory Board at Columbia, at Yale, my alma mater. And I do a lot of teaching about entrepreneurship. And the first thing that you let every entrepreneur know, every wannabe entrepreneur know, is that this is tough. Being an entrepreneur is one of the toughest careers you can choose, because bad stuff will happen, absolutely guaranteed. And since you're the one who's running the whole ship, when it happens to you, and it can be very, very, very bad. When my first company went down, the first year media with lots of venture capital and lots of users, 120 people on staff, that was, until that point, the biggest single disappointment of my life, the biggest failure. And it was really depressing. And I cried myself to sleep. It was really bad. But then you pick yourself up and you start doing it again. And most important thing is to maintain your integrity and never sell out and do the right thing. And if you are doing the right thing for the right reasons and have your integrity, things go wrong. Entrepreneurs will fail, and every entrepreneur does fail. But if you're to be an entrepreneur, you've got to accept the fact that it's going to happen. You don't just have to fail. But one failure does not mean you back up and go home and work on an assembly line. It means you keep going, you learn from your mistakes, and you try again. So
I mean, it sounds like you've ran through failure for like 15 years. I mean,
it was challenging. Absolutely. I mean, you know, it was. So the question is, why do you do this? And one of the things I found that, you know, with 25 years, 30 years now as an entrepreneur, is that entrepreneurs are crazy. And angel investors, the average angel investor has over 10 years experience as an entrepreneur him or herself, and started two or three different businesses. And so therefore, angel investors typically are distilled craziness. So I live these days in a world of crazies on both sides, and I'm certainly part of that. And so you have to have a calling, you know, a vocation from the Latin vocare to be called to the originally to the priesthood, but you have to know that this is what you want to do. And I get lots of business school students who come by my office and looking for career advice. You know, should I be a venture capitalist? Should I be an entrepreneur? And I make the point that if you're asking that question, you've already made a decision because you already know the answer. Because if you're an entrepreneur, you have such a calling, such a drive, you have to do this. And no matter how many times you're punched down, you'll get up and you'll try it again because that's what entrepreneurship is about.
What about with your wife? I mean, don't tell us about it if you don't want to, but it sounds like it would stress on your relationship. Like, how do you manage that?
There are differing people are natural entrepreneurs to different extents, and I believe it's a spectrum. Some people need to have Richard Branson win. I mean, this guy is, you put him on a desert island, he'll be selling coconuts to the seagulls kind of thing. Total hypomanic entrepreneur. But on the other hand, there are people who absolutely no way, never, ever how would touch anything entrepreneurial and don't want to do it. My wonderful spouse is in that end of the spectrum. So in one sense, it's a good marriage because we are completely different end of the spectrum, and it's a very, very supportive. It took a couple of years break between ventures before we got started again in the entrepreneurial world. But she's very supportive of what I do, and these days secondhand enjoys the retailing of the experiences over here.
When you had like your business career like falling apart for various days, how did you manage to not bring that home?
Well, at some point, people describe me as being preternaturally happy. I am an optimist, without question. And I think at some extent, you can't be a pessimistic entrepreneur because so much of entrepreneurship involves having faith in yourself and faith in your vision and the ability to keep going in the face of adversity. And so I am naturally extraordinarily optimistic, extraordinarily upbeat, perhaps inappropriately and crazily so. So, you know, I never lose my temper. I never shout and scream. I never get mad. And I accept the fact that that's unusual. So I have the ability somewhat to separate, but also I try not to let it affect me. If you're down the dumps all the time, you can't be the entrepreneur. You have to have faith. So I think it's partly personality. So I did keep the home life somewhat separated from the business life, but that's challenging.
Yeah, no, I bet. All right. The thing I hear about you is this angel group. And I'm interested that you mentioned that they're all these type A's. I don't really know much about angels particularly. Maybe can you tell us a little bit about who are the typical types of angels we have in your group and what do you guys do and how it works and all that sort of stuff?
Sure. So angel, the difference, most people think of all kinds of financing in one big pot. So, oh yeah, they're banks, there's VCs, there's angels. They often use one word without spaces, angels and VCs, or VCs and angels, it's the same kind of thing. If you think about the whole financing world, the timelines are very, very different. I mean, banking goes back to the Phoenicians, thousands of years ago. Stock markets go back to the London Stock Exchange, 1788. Venture capital firms, the first venture capital firm was founded after World War II by General George Doriot in the 1950s. And the first angel groups were only founded in the late 1980s, early 1990s. So that the timelines are quite different. And the essential difference between venture capitalists and angel investors is that venture capitalists, or VCs, are professional money managers who go out and raise a fund of other people's money, usually institutional, from pension funds or insurance companies or university endowments or super rich people and so on. And then they pick early stage companies where they can apply that money to get high returns. And so they are compensated by getting a piece of the profits that they make on other people's money. In contrast, angel investors are individual people who invest their own money out of their own pocket into early stage companies. And because of that essential difference, there are differences in the size. So a typical venture capital fund might be a fund of $100 million these days or $200 million, whereas there are no angels or few angels who have anything like that money. So venture capital funds historically have invested in the few million range to a few tens of millions, whereas angel investors out of their own pockets typically invest tens of thousands to low hundreds of thousands. And that means that angel investors tended to invest earlier in the cycle when companies are just starting up, whereas VCs tend to invest a little later in the cycle when they've had a little more traction. So you're looking at people who are investing their own money out of their own pocket into companies that they know where they're betting on the entrepreneur. And because most angels have some experience of their own in entrepreneurship or early-stage companies, they also try and add value by helping the company through their networks and through advice and sometimes even management. And so those are the kinds of people who look for early-stage companies to invest. And so what happened in the 1990s was you found these individual people investing in individual companies, and they bump into each other, and you'd find people in the same deal and say, hey, why don't we pool our deal flow so we can see deals I might like that you might not want and vice versa, and then pool our money so we can, if we're each putting in $50,000, together we put in $100,000, and then pool our advice and so on. So that was the origin of angel groups, some of the very first ones like LORE, loosely organized retired executives down in Pennsylvania, and Band of Angels out in California, begin to get together. And when you get 50 or 100 or 200 people into a group, all sharing their deal flow and their expertise and their money, you begin to get something that has a lot of reach and can do a lot of interesting things. Because the big challenge.
How do you end up doing it? Because one of the things that a friend of mine is Dave McClure. I guess you've heard of that in Silicon Valley.
I know Dave.
So he's doing a lot of some types of investing. One of the things that he talks about is where he'll place some small bets and he'll increase the bet with companies that he can see is gaining traction, and then he just kind of lets the others, I guess, go to the wayside. as an angel, if you're on the very bleeding edge of the game, so you're always in the initial round, you don't have the scale to be able to do lots of follow-on investments. So therefore, it seems like you guys are taking most of the risk and potentially getting diluted out by VCs or other people later on. Like, how good are the returns as an angel investor?
Well, that's a very perceptive question, and the answer is it's very tricky to do it right, and it's not so much a science. It's partly art, partly science, and a lot to do with portfolio diversification, because nobody can pick early stage companies right all the time, even a majority of the time, and the statistics are pretty interesting in terms of early stage stuff, which is the majority of all angel investments fail completely. If you do 10 investments, 5 of them, you can expect and you should expect are going to wipe out within the first year or two and crash and burn and literally lose your entire investment. That's 50% of your money right down the tubes day one. And so if you then look at the rest of it, you know, of the next 5, you know, 2 of them maybe a few years later will give you back the money you put in. So you don't make anything there and you've lost the value of that money over time. And then 2 more, you'll have an exit of some kind, be bought by a larger company or whatever, and will return, you know, 2 or 3 times the money you put in, which would be pretty good, except it's taken, you know, 5-6 years to do that, and by the time you put those hit wins against offsetting the losses, you're effectively back to zero. And that means that your whole portfolio ends up riding on one company, which you hope to be a real home run. But the thing is, if you invested at an early stage in a relatively appropriate or modest valuation on that one company, and that company then becomes a, you know, $50 million or $100 million company, the returns, you know, 20 or 30 times return of your money on that one company out of 10. Means that in total, your portfolio over time has an IRR in 20 to 30% range. And if you take a look at the returns of different kinds of funds, from private equity funds to venture funds to early stage seed funds to angel investing, it turns out that the earlier stage at which you invest, if you do it correctly with enough diversification and enough holding, over time, the earlier at which you invest, the greater the returns. And so a number of studies have shown that the average return from sophisticated investors who have a large portfolio in the earliest stages of angel investing is in the 20 to 30% IRR range, which is actually quite good.
So if a guy like Fred Wilson, I mean, he sits further up the food chain, where would his IRRs be?
Well, I don't know exactly what Fred is in Square Ventures. Fred is actually not all that much farther north. So Fred is a very early stage fund, what USB does. I mean, so they won't invest in companies with, you know, long-term, you know, growth financing at the, you know, $50 or $100 million valuation. So they would be the next level after us. So his returns are likely better than, you know, most of the later stage VCs. Typically, VCs, you know, would love to show, you know, 20% IRR, you know, net to their investors if they're taking out the 20% of that the VC himself takes. So typical, you know, VCs would love to show a 20% return to their investors. In actuality, however, the sad fact is that the majority of venture capital funds in the U.S. that have been found in the last 10 years are actually underwater. They've actually lost money. So it's a very risky business for angels and VCs and entrepreneurs. But that's what we're all in it, going in, understanding the risk.
And you have obviously a massive competitive advantage now because you have your angel network locally, and then you've got the angel supplying software that's being used around the world. So you have a much bigger reach into that field.
Well, not necessarily, because the angel soft, you know, we have no leverage on angel soft that anybody else doesn't have. Angel soft is a tool platform that provides the back end infrastructure for all the world's angel groups. And so what that does to everybody, unless you source, we have an area called Open Deals, in which angel groups that are looking to syndicate deals can pose a deal and say, hey, we've got you know, part of this deal, find us, who would like to join us in funding this deal. And entrepreneurs themselves can pose into that area, and you know, so therefore be available, be accessible by, you know, all 20,000 investors. So to that extent, you know, anybody can use angel soft to broaden their reach in deal flow.
Some of them are going to come. People are going to come directly to you and say, "Hey, you know, you're the guy. We want you."
Oh, I mean, in terms of deal flow, sure. You know, the more that I have you know, been involved, the longer you stick around the angel world, the more you're known as an angel, the more you blog about it and write about it and speak about it and have exits. You know, people like Dave McClure, you know, who's active both VC and angel investor on his own, get deal flow. And so, you know, those of us who are very active angels get people coming directly to us, which we try and encourage, which is great. But you know, for the average angel who doesn't have that profile and doesn't do it on such a full-time basis, that's why they belong to the angel groups, which in turn go out and actively try to market themselves and get companies to submit plans to them. So one of the major functions of angel groups is to provide deal flow for angels who themselves don't have a lot of deal flow.
Yeah, maybe you've seen Jason talking about the paper presentation and stuff like that. I'm interested in your thoughts on that area.
Well, sure. I mean, I know I've known Jason for 20 years since he started in the whole New York area over here. And his jihad, as is, is against angel, quote, angels, unquote, or unquote, angel groups, unquote, that charge entrepreneurs to be able to pitch. Jason paints with a rather broad brush, shall we say, and doesn't do nuance. And in reality, there is some nuance here. There are people, it's a spectrum. It goes from light to dark. And on the dark side are events and groups that charge literally $10,000 or $15,000 for a company to have the, quote, opportunity, unquote, to present their pitch to a room full of people. And, you know, I don't think that makes any sense. I agree with him. That really is making money in the backs of entrepreneurs who don't have much of a chance of getting funded. You know, on the other extreme, you have, you know, angel groups that are not-for-profit entities that charge very small amounts of money, you know, $50, $100, $200 to companies to help to pay their expenses for the meeting and, you know, their small staff and so on, but where the individual people don't make money on it. It's just an expense thing. And the Angel Capital Association in the U.S. has established a total fee limit of $500. So if you so they say that any group that belongs to the Angel Capital Association shouldn't charge more than $500 in total to entrepreneurs throughout the whole process. And I think that's not
unreasonable. Why would it be any kind of regulation? I mean, it's free market, it's free world. People want tasting grain to go and speak to someone. I don't have a problem with that.
No, absolutely. And there is no regulation, and that's the part of the problem. So, but Jason is a populist, and Jason has a broad following, and he's gotten a lot of readership out of this. And part of it is that there are a large number of entrepreneurs who are always being generated. I liken the analogy to fish swimming in a fast-moving river. They're being spawned upstream, and they keep swimming down, and every day there are new fish swimming down that river. And every day the fishermen, who would be the investors, come to the same bank. So it's the same thing every day for the investors, but a new thing every day for the entrepreneurs. And so an entrepreneur who hasn't heard of this might look at a fancy web posting or ad for some kind of event that says, if you pay us $15,000, we will put you in front of all people who will give you lots of money. And so they don't know any better. And so they'll pay the money. And in reality, they would have almost zero chance of getting funded from that event. And so what Jason is trying to do, maybe a little heavy-handedly, but he's trying to warn people against that. In general, he's right. And it's an interesting question for the whole field when you get out of the smaller areas. If you are a not-for-profit angel group of individuals who are trying to look at deals and increase your deal flow, is it inappropriate to ask entrepreneurs to who you are getting there going there to listen to pay $100 to help defray the cost of the meeting and your administrative staff and so on? So that's a legit question. Somebody ultimately has to pay something somewhere. So Jason started his own angel group called the Open Angel Forum, which he is funding by having service providers pay for it. So lawyers and others do it. So and one could say, all right, fine. Does it make sense? Is it appropriate for investors who anoint a particular service provider because they're paying money to get the group going? You can look at this several ways, but it's right now a very wild and woolly business. And what we're trying to do with AngelSoft, with the tool platform, is to provide a somewhat standardized way of reducing costs across the whole board, standardizing things and making everything transparent. So because AngelSoft is the back-end platform for all these groups, you can go on AngelSoft and look up New York Angels, and you can see exactly how much money we fund into how many deals and over what kind of time, how many people have checked in the last month, what our average time to look at a deal is, where our average time to funding is, full transparency. And we think that that's really good because entrepreneurs can now see in the real world, listening to post sales pitches, exactly what happens.
I want to ask about your incubator co-working space. You said you have five floors of stuff going on there.
Yeah, well, so being involved in New York Angels, most angel groups tend to invest in a particular region, particular industry, particular stage of company. In the case of New York Angels, we have really interesting members. We have most of the major technology investors in New York belong to our group, people like Esther Dyson and Alan Patrickoff and so on. We tend to invest in companies that have started up, have shown some traction. They've typically been around for a year, maybe a little longer than that. The entrepreneur has put in a little bit of money. They've got a product that's either shipping or ready to ship. They have customers or prospective customers or beta customers. I wanted to invest in these early stage companies, and I wanted to be close to the companies in which I invest. Some of them only had two or three or four people. And so I opened an incubator here where they could relatively inexpensively get into office space and be near me, start to provide advice and so on. And then the next thing you know, we had other people wanting space, similar space that I was invested in. So we said, sure, as long as you're good guys and in the tech space and can add value to the whole thing, you come and do. And then with the world is getting less and less expensive to start companies, and you can now start a cloud-based company really cheaply with one person and a cat. You do it in Starbucks. But I said, okay, there's a trend to co-working spaces, so open areas where you could, for relatively low amounts of money, pick up a desk and spend time there, 24-hour access with internet and phones and everything else.
So we opened up included as well?
Yeah, it doesn't include the cats, but we have, the company has a hamster, and we have a couple of dogs, so we're sort of pet friendly. And so we have probably 15 or so companies, on a couple of floors here, ranging from one person to I think 7 is the biggest, that are in varying stages of startup, from people with an idea who are working to get themselves to the point where they are ready to approach angels for funding, all the way up to some venture-backed companies that have relatively small teams and find the space conducive. And since New York Angels also has its offices here, as does Astia, which is the international nonprofit that helps win entrepreneurial businesses. They're here. Angels also is headquartered here. Rose Tech Ventures.
Do you have 5 floors? I mean, how many people are there working with?
We have in total, but probably 50 or 100. No, see, 75 across the whole operation.
You have 75 guys sitting churning out ideas for businesses they're trying to start.
Well, they're different companies. So, 20 of some out of them are in Angels, which is our company here doing this back-end platform. We had a large floor taken over by a startup that started small. An angel investor came in for angel investor space and had a startup, and the startup got bigger. Then they got venture funded, so they're a full floor. And we have just a couple of floors of incubator and co-working space, ranging from open areas to small offices with 1, 2, 3-person jobs. So it's a pretty extended. We're sitting in right middle of the Flatiron District, which is known as the Silicon Alley here in Manhattan, and right across the street from a snack bar in Madison Square Park called the Shake Shack, which is a Danny Meyer restaurant. Danny Meyer is one of the world's great restaurateurs, and he has this super-duper gourmet hamburger stand, which has become the center of all of the New York technology community. And so the lines are took an hour-long line to get a hamburger, and we are right on top of that. And so we're a very interesting central nexus point for the technology community here in New York.
I didn't know. That's really interesting. So let's say someone wants to get started in your co-working space. How does that work?
They apply and they say, hey, here's my business. I'd like to get a desk or two or three. And we're very open, and provided they are in the tech startup arena, which we think contributes to the whole feeling of the place, we welcome them to come in, and it's no long-term commitment, month to month. And we have a no-bozo policy, so we don't look for jerks. We're not looking for real estate salespeople or people who are making a lot of noise in the co-working space. So it's actually pretty quiet here. People working on computers, 1, 2, 3-person teams, all in the technology arena. We have various events where every Friday we have what's called Free Lunch Friday, where we bring in a guest speaker, either somebody in marketing or somebody in technology or venture capitalists or whatever, or me, and do a presentation to everybody and provide pizza or sushi or whatever. We have other kinds of events. For example, last week, the First Round Capital team, that's one of the leading VCs and early-stage VCs, came around and walked through, and their whole team spent a couple hours here meeting with our various entrepreneurs to hear about their businesses. We hosted a number of the New York meetups here in Oak Flight startups and other areas. So it's a pretty vibrant environment.
How much does it cost? Like one day, one person, you're going to get started?
Our starting rate right now is about $500 per desk per month. It goes up to a few $1,000 if you want a private office for several people and so on. So it's really cost effective. You could go to Starbucks cheaper, but they don't provide quite the environment here. So the goal here is not to run as a profit center, which we don't, but rather to run it at break even and provide additional deal flow for us and keeping our hand on fingers on what's going on in the community. Let people know that we're here and we exist, and basically do good.
No, because I went and actually checked out a couple of weeks ago, a couple of sites for co-working in New York, and one of the things that did surprise me was that they were small. Like, how big is the space?
We have 2,500 square foot floors, so we have a total of 5 floors. Two floors are devoted to one floor for the co-working space, one floor for the incubator, one floor for shared resources, which includes a boardroom and a video studio.
I just meant the space you actually end up working in. Like my office here, where I live in San Domingo, is massive. I live like a king, and I was looking at some of these working spaces guys have in Manhattan. And oh my god, that's I could put 5 of those into my office space.
Right. Well, again, it depends. The co-working floor is a totally open floor. There's one conference room, and the rest of the floor is open. And so you would you sit at a desk, with a nice sized desk in a 2,500 square foot open floor. In the demise offices, they're really small offices, 2-person offices, 3-person offices. This is New York, so you're not going to have one person with 10,000 square feet of space. But it's, again, depending on what you're looking for, open space, private office, whatever, it may or may not work for you.
Right. And does that symbol that build back to the angel investing side?
Some. Again, New York Angels gets probably 20 to 30 applications each month for funding. We only have, 15 or so companies, in the building here. So we wouldn't provide that much of a percentage of the deal flow to New York Angels or to me. But again, it helps the community. It raises our profile. People come in, visit. And so we certainly see a lot of companies here. So I'm very pleased with the way it's worked out.
So as part of what you've done, you've also had one or two angel and entrepreneur residences.
Right. The EIR, entrepreneur residence, is designed to help the entrepreneurs in the building as well as help them manage it. So our first entrepreneur residence was Nate Westheimer, who had been a young entrepreneur, started a company, did a good job at it, didn't work out. And so when he announced that he was closing that down, I invited him to come on and be our full-time EIR for the incubator, co-working space. And he did a wonderful job and really helped the community, helped the entrepreneurs who were here as well as having a larger community. And then he was eventually elected as the organizer of the New York Tech Meetup, taking over from Scott Heifernan, who had founded it. So Nick now runs New York Tech Meetup and is also then took a full-time job as VP of Product Development at AnyClip. So he's really involved. He was then succeeded by Ryan Jansen, who was the Chief Operating Officer of Angelsoft, our company here, who after 5 years of helping build Angelsoft, decided to go out and start his own company. So Ryan has spent half a year here as our EIR, during which he created a company called SetJam, which is doing some really cool stuff in the online video space. And now our latest entrepreneur is we actually changed. We no longer have an entrepreneur in residence. We now have a breakthrough thing, which we're experimenting with trying. We have an EIT, an entrepreneur in training. A young guy named Bo Bell, who had happened to cross my path looking for suggestions as to what to do with tech space. He was finishing his PhD, and after talking to him for 10 minutes, I said, wait a minute, this guy is an entrepreneur and doesn't know it. He never considered being an entrepreneur, but he has all the entrepreneurial spark and passion and self-sufficiency and so on. So, like sort of like Henry Higgins and Liza Duple, I said, why don't you come in and let's see if we can help you be a real entrepreneur. So Bo has just started, and as an entrepreneur in training, we're going to let all the other entrepreneurs in the building help mentor him, and he's going to blog about it, and hopefully he can teach my learning, and as he works up, gets a company started, and learns the ropes of being a sophisticated entrepreneur, other people can learn alongside him by reading his blog and helping him provide advice. So we'll see how that works out.
Very interesting. I want to ask one last quick question about just New York in general, the New York community.
Mm-hmm.
So as you mentioned that in New York, the tech scene is really taking off. I think you were telling me a little bit before the call. The tech scene is really starting to get a lot of traction. One of the reasons for that, obviously, one maybe even the reason, is because of Wall Street going down. And my understanding of it is that Wall Street, with their high salaries, basically sucked all the oxygen out of the room because anyone that was going to do something got recruited, anyone who had some talent got recruited by a hedge fund or whatever, and it's a bit hard to compete with somebody like $500,000 a year salaries when you might make 70 or 80 starting in tech. I don't know if my number's quite right, but you know, maybe the general order of magnitude. Wall Street's on a little bit of a downturn, but I would be fairly confident that it's going to come back at some point. I'm interested in what your thoughts would be of what would happen to the tech community if that does come back.
Well, it's actually a very interesting analysis, and your numbers are actually relatively close. We actually lost a couple of people from Angelsoft here who were offered salaries of, you know, $300,000 at JP Morgan, which we can't possibly compete with. And I said, hey, take it. Oh, you have to go. You owe to your family and take that kind of a salary increase. And so there is less competition now on the one hand for those kind of coders. On the other hand, I think this change is much bigger than that. I don't think it's just the downturn that freed up competition for programming talent. I think as New York developing the ecosystem that Silicon Valley had in California around companies that had been here from the mid-90s got big, and some were successful, some weren't, but the people had experience in the entrepreneurial world and startup ventures and technology. Now, increasingly in New York, you see advertising technology, things that are tying in financial services, other areas, and so you have a very vibrant community here. People are coming into New York to be with this high-tech community of startups, and you have the New York Tech Meetup, which has over 12,000 members. The Israeli Entrepreneur Meetup in New York has over 1,000 members, just Israeli tech entrepreneurs in New York City. It's pretty amazing.
That's the thing.
So I think we now have the critical mass, and the growth rate of early-stage tech startups and venture-funded tech startups is faster and higher in New York now than in anywhere else in the country, including Silicon Valley. So you're seeing all kinds of venture funds open offices here. First Round Capital just opened an office here. Polaris just opened a Dogpath, which is their incubator here. Flybridge from Boston is coming down and has consultants here. So you have all kinds of stuff happening, and it's happening not because, of the less competition for high-paying jobs in the tech world, but because of the growth of the indigenous tech community here in New York.
But you don't think once Wall Street comes back and then there's $300,000 a year salaries again, and is that not going to just
No, I don't think so. I think quite the opposite. I think when Wall Street comes back, it'll just be more, you'll see more in the way of financial services, and you'll see people coming in for those kinds of jobs. But I think we are now, there will always be people who want to participate in the entrepreneurial startup world with the promise of potentially large paydays and exciting work and challenging kinds of things. And I think those will continue. It used to be that was a very small part of the New York community. At the height of the boom, you had 8,000 members in there. You now have 12, in an area now we don't have a boom going on. You've got 12,000 members in your community, and you have all kinds of companies that are getting funded and VCs funding here. So I think we now reach a state of hardiness, as it were, that will be only a great way to grow for the future.
Very good. Anything you want to tell us in closing?
No, it's my pleasure. I mean, New York is a great place to locate a startup these days. There is a vibrant community here. Angel investors are a wonderful source of financing. What we're seeing increasingly now is more understanding of the high-tech startup world from potential angel investors. More and more angels are growing. This growth of angel investors is really significant around the country. Groups, angel groups have helped to get back going, so now somebody can join a group and learn about how to be angel. By the same token, things like AngelSoft have helped to standardize angel investing around the world and the Angel Capital Association and courses and how to raise funds. As usual, we're seeing a lot more transparency, growth in the individual financing of early stage businesses. And this is, I think, a great time to be both an entrepreneur and an angel investor. So whichever way you go, we're in for some very exciting times.
Very cool. David, thank you a ton.
My pleasure.